It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to. Lots to talk about. Labor Day weekend. Going to get into some of that. The job numbers are out. Want to talk a little bit about that. I do want to start off with our cover-up caucus. You've got these congressmen who are kind of afraid of what their phone records might show on Insurrection Day, threatening the telecom companies that if you hand over anything, we'll remember. And we're going to come for you. You know, I got to tell you, sounds like a threat to me. Sounds like a pretty major threat when Congress is going after people going, no, you withhold information. You don't let the public see in a transparent fashion the things that we, their representatives, were doing. I'm sorry. Look, you know, average everyday people get a warrant, go to court, do that. But our representatives, especially in a congressional hearing, that's fair game. The cover-up caucus, the GOP cover-up caucus, consisting of Lauren Boebert of Colorado, Marjorie Taylor Trader Greene of Georgia, Jim Jordan of Ohio, Andy Biggs of Arizona, Paul Gosar of Arizona, Mo Brooks of Alabama, Madison Cawthorn of North Carolina, Matt Gaetz of Florida, Louis Gogo Gohmert of Texas, Jody Heiss of Georgia, and my congressman, Scott Perry. Congressman Perry right here, Mr. Upstanding, good military guy, clean cut, part of the cover-up. And I want to know what Scott Perry was doing on the day. I mean, there's some interesting information out there. I want to know what our general was doing while the commander-in-chief was leading a coup attempt. Was he involved in it? Could, you know, this is one of those moments where I reach out to Scott Perry. This could be your Smedley Butler moment. This could be where, for the good of the country, you step forward and go, this is what happened. Be the Boy Scout everyone tells me you are. Step forward, tell the truth. It's all anybody's asking for. Nobody's asking for you to lie. No one's asking you for to make stuff up. Tell the truth. And with the truth comes these records that you're threatening these companies to withhold. I really have a problem with this. We're in a really bizarre moment in this country where you've got politicians outwardly writing letters in public saying, if you follow the law, if you do what the investigation, the congressional investigation, is asking of you, we will hold this against you. We will single you out and we will come after you. Now, look, I have no love for the telecom companies, but this is a bridge too far. This is a bridge way too far. The Republican Party's gotten away with way too much as of the last several years. And it's time to rein some of that in, and transparency being the big part of it. Look, if there are Democrats who are making calls to Donald Trump on Insurrection Day, if there's a Democrat who called Dumb Jr. or called Mo Brooks, I want to know. I want to know who they were talking about. I want to know what they were talking about. But what we know is it was the Republicans who were coordinating with the Trump campaign and with Trump himself on the movements of what was going on. And look, I got to tell you, if they're putting up this kind of a fuss, if they're putting up this kind of a threat, I got to think there's something there. What's that? He doth protest too much? Too much. So now it's like Trump's tax returns. Got to see those at some point. I got to see what crimes are in there. Do I think it was anything that would have gotten him impeached? No. It might have made him look bad a little bit. He's not as rich as he said he was. He took tax breaks he shouldn't have taken. He did some creative accounting, said properties were worth more when it benefited him to say that, and worth less when it benefited him to say that. Yeah, rich people do that kind of thievery all the time. Wasn't going to get him impeached. Slap on the wrist, make him look bad. Maybe. But what's in there that's making him double, triple, quadruple down? Makes you suspicious. It just does. So we got to see these records. Got to know who was responsible for January 6th. And it's not going to happen before September 18th when Insurrection 2.0, which some of the organizers are kind of pulling back a little bit on the idea we're going to have a big raucous affair. No, because it is going to be the most militarized. And congratulations, dimwits. You have now made every rally that we'll ever have a militarized zone. Because you can't be trusted. Nice job. And I know, but Rick, you wouldn't mind Antifa. No, I've spoken out against breaking windows and breaking things. Absolutely. But you don't go trying to usurp democracy. You don't get to do that. Sorry. Anyway, Labor Day weekend. It's one of the days that we're celebrating our 16th anniversary. On the air, I can't believe it's been 16 years we've been doing this program, but it has been an incredible 6 years and given us opportunities to do things that I've just been thrilled with. Our 2013 Labor History Tour, 2015 we did a Civil Rights Tour. I've gotten to interview presidential candidates, and I've gotten to go to conventions and all kinds of things to bring labor's message and the message of working people to the halls of power. And I've been grateful for every opportunity I've had. And going forward, our growth this year has been incredible. We've added stations in New York City and now in Los Angeles, in Georgia. We are expanding like never before. And it's because working people have finally come around to the idea of we need unions. We need to organize. We need to fight for better wages, hours, conditions, opportunities. We need better for our children. We need better for our seniors. That the supply side voodoo Reaganomics, tax cuts for the rich at every opportunity, that scheme didn't work. And it's put us in the situation we're in. And the things I've been talking about all 16 years of doing this show, finally now people are going, hey, that's a good idea. We should tax the rich like we used to in the good old socialist days of Dwight Eisenhower. We should have strong labor unions like we did, back before the sainted Ronnie Reagan. Because here's the thing. Labor Day is a day brought to you by labor. Labor Day is now under attack virtually every direction by corporate America, by right-wing rabid politicians, and by well-funded attack groups, who their only mission is to take your ability to have a say on the job away. It's all about power. And I whenever I think of this, I think of my grandfather who said, if a rich guy's going to take a buck out of his pocket to say you don't need something, you better spend two to get it. We better be spending three or four. Because here in Pennsylvania, in the next year, there's a potential in 2023, because of next year's elections, that we could be the next no rights at work state. All of my Republican operative friends are all giddy and all tingly in the panties at the prospect of destroying a solid labor state like Pennsylvania. And look, solid labor state means about 12% of the workforce, of the private sector workforce. We're about 6% nationwide. When I started working years ago, it was like 25%. And the attacks have been coming nonstop. And we're at an interesting moment because the most recent Gallup poll says that 68% of people approve of labor unions. We need to pass the PRO Act. MIT did a study that found 1 in 2 workers would join a union tomorrow if they had the opportunity. And yet, here we are in this moment. Like I said, only 6% of workers belong to labor unions. And that's because the pendulum has swung so far to the employer class. So far to the wealth class. They don't want you to have any rights. They don't want you to have a say. They want you to have nothing. Why has the minimum wage not gone up in 12 years? Because workers don't have the power to demand it, and right-wing politicians know it. and they block it at every single opportunity. And what's going on is not only have politicians not helped us, but the court system has been where they have waged the most aggressive war on working people. Yesterday, the big story was the Supreme Court basically said abortion in this country is going to be bad. And now everyone's up in arms. Oh, my gosh, look what the Supreme Court did. And you go, yeah, this is what they've been doing through the entire Roberts term. I've been saying they're going to take us back to the good old days of the Lochner era and before, where if you're hungry enough, desperate enough to work in poverty conditions for poverty wages, hey, it's your choice, buddy. That's your liberty. And labor has been the place where the Roberts courts have been one of the most aggressive destroyers. Craig Becker, AFL-CIO General Counsel, had an interesting statement in this Take Back the Courts piece that they've put out. He said, quote, I must inform you that the labor movement, its leaders, its lawyers, and its members no longer believe labor organizations and working people seeking to act together to improve their wages, hours, and conditions can obtain a fair hearing before the court. Because it's rigged. The Supreme Court completely rigged with anti-worker, anti-labor voices. The abortion thing, absolutely. They're anti that as well, but they're pro-corporate. At the end of the day, they were put on that court for their votes to swing all of the power to corporations. And they've done that. They've done that dutifully. And yet every time we don't have the big outrage. We don't have the mass protests like we're going to see. And fortunately, we're going to see over this abortion ban. Maybe this is the moment where people wake up and go, oh, my God, you know, Rick's right. The Supreme Court's been horrible for the entire Roberts term. What do we do? You know, in 2012, I was screaming about the Knox case, the Knox versus SEIU case, that Alito basically set up for the next attack. It basically created an opt-in system. But his thing, his writings on this, set up for what would be the end of the Abood decision, which had been the law of the land since 1977, and what eventually brought us the Janus case. It had been Friedrich's. Scalia died. It was still there. They couldn't wait. They were chomping at the bit. They brought another case, the Janus versus AFSCME case, and Trump's guy, Gorsuch, was the vote that put it over the top. And in one vote, you overturned decades of decided law and made the entire country a no-rights-at-work country for public sector workers. That's the power the Supreme Court had. One felt swoop attacked unions' ability to operate by taking away money that they needed to operate while mandating that they still have to represent the free riders. And this is all by choice. This is all by plan. The next thing after the Knox case that Alito is the driver in all this. The Harris versus Quinn case. Alito again invited this attack on Abood to get to Janus. Then there was the Epic Systems case in 2018. That said, you know what? You can force your workers to sign arbitration clauses. Even your workers of 20 years. My aunt called me. Her employer of 20 years had put a piece of paper in front of her and said, sign this or get out. Sign this arbitration clause that says if we sexually harass you, if we do anything, if we violate any federal law or any law, you have to go to arbitration. You can't go to court. They stole her constitutional right to hold them accountable by saying, no, we're going to go to these arbitrators. Of course, the arbitrators that they control. And the vast majority of workers in this country, they've signed these arbitration clauses without even knowing it. Now, of course, this had been in place for consumers for a couple of years before that. There was the Johnson Control case, and there was the AT&T case, and there were some other things that mandated this. But this is now your 20-year employer. Sign it or get out. And then, of course, there's Janus, that virtually starved public sector unions of resources to fight for their members. And what does that mean? No resources, no ability to hold employers accountable, no ability to hire lawyers to go and sue where you have to and enforce the contract, and a weakening of the union. Why? Because they don't want to deal with them. They want pliable unions who will just go along so they can blame everything on and not actually give them the opportunity to represent their members. And then there's this self-fulfilling prophecy. The more you can tick workers off that they're not getting anything, the more they don't join. It's masterful what they've done. They've used the courts to do this death of a thousand paper cuts thing. And now this year, they decided the Cedar Point nursery case. The court had held for 46 years under California law that union organizers would have limited access to private property in the agricultural industry to talk to agricultural workers to get them to organize. Because how else are you going to get to these people? They're on private property. They're generally housed on that property. It's basically a company town of private property. So the law said, nope, we're going to make sure that you get access at least once or twice a year so that you can go talk to people and find out what's going on and try and help them help themselves. This Supreme Court said, no, it's a property rights thing. Sorry, you don't get to do this. And the thing is the court is so badly rigged by such a small handful of people. In fact, as they point out in this piece on taking back the courts, they find that 43% of all cases before the Supreme Court were argued and filed by 66 lawyers. And what they also found is the majority of those 66, 51 of them worked at law firms that represent corporate special interests only, and the majority of them actually were clerks for Supreme Court justices. So it's this incestuous little pool of people who, well, are bought and paid for by our corporate special interests, making decisions about the entire working class of this country, and not in a good way. So yeah, our court system's broken badly, and working people need to know it. So this Labor Day, think about the Supreme Court and how bad it's screwed over every working person in this country. Just my thought. Going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. Nothing more American than workers standing up, and the union gives a voice to win. On the Rick Smith Show. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1875. That was the day anti-black violence erupted into a two-day massacre in Clinton, Mississippi. As many as 2,500 black Republicans and their families met at Moss Hill, a former plantation destroyed during the Civil War. The day was one of festivities and political speeches ahead of the fall elections. The county Republican Party invited local Democrats to debate. The Democratic state senatorial candidate did address the crowd. The editor of a local Republican newspaper and union officer, Captain H.T. Fisher, followed him. Soon, a group of white Democrats began to heckle Fisher as he spoke. Republican politicians attempted to quell the growing tensions. Almost immediately, however, the heckling whites opened fire on the crowd. Women and children fled in all directions as black Republican forces rushed to defend themselves and their families. By the end of the day, three whites and five blacks were killed. Clinton's mayor fed off rumors of black retaliation. He called upon white paramilitary forces, the White Liners, from surrounding areas for assistance. Several hundred answered the call and filled the town's streets. Historian Melissa Janczewski-Jones notes that though heavily armed, the White Liners accompanied white locals as they rampaged door to door looking for black Republicans to murder. After 2 days, as many as 50 black Clintonians were killed by white Democrats looking to end Reconstruction and regain political control of Mississippi. A Senate committee would later conclude, quote, "The riots at Clinton were part of a special purpose on the part of the Democrats to break up the meetings of Republicans and inaugurate an era of terror not only in those communities, but throughout the state.
Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So job numbers out today. 235,000 new jobs. They're saying major disappointment. They were expecting 720,000. And look, I agree with Joe Biden. I think a lot of the slowing in hiring has happened because we're spiking again. The Delta variant is causing more people to get sick, more consumers to pull back. Not good moments. Which is why I keep saying we need to have some really massive investments in our infrastructure to get people back to work, doing the right things. Hopefully we wake up at some point. But this is the reason we need that. I'm here to share some thoughts on the disappointing job numbers, or if they are disappointing. That's just my view. I'm curious what my next guest has to say. Mateus Fernando is an economics professor there at Bucknell University. Mateus, thanks for taking time for us.
No, thank you for having me.
So 235,000 new jobs, is they were expecting 720. Is that a bad thing?
Well, I mean, obviously, if you're expecting, you know, expectations play a huge role in this. So if you expect a huge increase and it's considerably less, and it was considerably less, it's a disappointment. So I think that it's fine that Biden acknowledged that and went with that story. On the other hand, in terms of think of the recovery in the previous recession with Obama, in which we did not do a significantly large fiscal package, in part because there was dissent within the Democratic Party, and in part because at that point, the people that had the upper hand in the Democratic Party were people like Larry Summers, who now is barking from outside. So it took us to get back to 5.2 unemployment. And remember, unemployment levels were really much at 14%, whatever it was, my memory now. But, we were two digits, and we were considering a catastrophe of the size of the Great Depression. And we're at 5.2, which it's pretty good and pretty fast. So as recessions come, this was pretty fast. What was important in that is that not only we had the fiscal packages, but we have all kinds of protections for those that were, the most vulnerable in the job market, in particular the extension of unemployment insurance, which is sort of ended ironically, as we come to Labor Day. And so I think so far we did pretty well, and this is less disappointing than people might think it is. Given the circumstances, which you just said, we 3 months ago, we all thought this is probably over. So, we're now it's a question of getting some people, perhaps in certain regions, to get vaccinated. But, we're the worst is over. And it seems that that's clearly not the case. And so given all of those circumstances, the numbers look pretty good. So I'll be less gloomy about the job markets than I am about the pandemic.
Yeah, but you look at the 5.2% unemployment rate, and how much of that is just playing with numbers, because still worker participation is still really, really low, and I still think we've got a long way to go. And I come back to where I started, which is we need massive government investment in our infrastructure for a plethora of reasons. Because one, we need it. Two, we got climate change to deal with. And three, we need the jobs to help the economy get us back to bringing people back to the labor pool.
Yeah, no, don't make me try to defend. I'm trying to defend the numbers, and I tend to agree with everything you said. When I teach this at Bucknell, one of the things I do say to the kids, and this week I made them do an exercise exactly on that, looking at different levels of unemployment and looking at the participation rates, because the participation rates peaked in the late 2000s, in the Clinton boom. And that was the highest ever in the history of the U.S. job, labor market, at about 67 and something, And it has been declining ever since. I should say the part that I think it's, up to that point, the growth of and the participation of women sort of compensated the fall in men's participation in the labor market up to that point. After that, things sort of changed, and in the last decade, in fact, women participation went down. So you're absolutely right. Participation is down. Even the 5.2 is not representative of the real situation in the job market. We still have like 5 million people that lost jobs, or you know, rounding up, that have not found jobs. We still have a fundamental need to, and we haven't had. I always say, don't get me wrong. I always say, U.S. had historically, since we have reasonable data on the labor market, full employment. We only had probably 4 times, and I'm being optimistic, and I'm not often optimistic. So it's Second World War. We had really low levels, and in the middle of Second World War for obvious reasons, war effort. Korean War, Vietnam War, and the Clinton bubble. There was a bubble in the dot-com market, and so there is a boom. There are many things that were positive, but there was a bubble too. And so it's three wars and a bubble. And I don't think we ever had the Obama boom, although they did have a fiscal package. There were good intentions. We extended the welfare state with Obamacare. We didn't get to full employment. The labor market has been in trouble for more than 20 years. And you know this, if we're going to go talk about, in particular, the manufacturing market, which I think it's fundamental for the well-being of American society, we're even in worse. It's been 40 years since this has been sort of in a difficult position. So I do agree with all those things. And we do need massive investment in infrastructure, in science and technology, in providing the resources. So if we're going to have the scientists and the engineers and the people that are going to do the things that we need to keep ahead and get our economy going, we need to provide them, relatively cheap education. We need to be concerned with the environment. And if there was a week for us to be concerned about the consequences of the environment, this was one. And so I do agree that the $3.5 billion that, I'm sorry to say that Manchin and Sinema seem to be sort of, flimsy. We do need that. We need the $1 trillion on infrastructure, and we need the $3.5 trillion. And that's contrary to what people think. I do agree on this with the progressives. Contrary to what people think, this is on the low end of what we need. And if anything, and I'm sorry I'm talking too much, but if anything, I think that this low numbers, what they show is we need more. So if there are fears of inflation, forget about those. The fears are that the pandemic will continue, and God knows for how long, and we should be, stepping on and trying to keep the economy afloat.
No, I'm right there with you. And this is where you say it's too low, and I agree with you 100%. It is too low, and I always point to the American Society of Civil Engineers and their most recent report that says we need $4.6 trillion in hard infrastructure. So that $1.2 trillion bipartisan deal is about $3.4 trillion short of where the American Society of Civil Engineers say we need to be.
Yeah, exactly. Now, I remember I used to teach at the University of Utah, and it was $2 trillion a decade and a half ago when I used to tell the numbers. It's clear. Anybody, you see the infrastructure, trains, airports, the roads, it's visible. This is a country in which, I always say, the U.S. is a country in which corporations do well, billionaires do well, but the people do poorly. And the reason that people do poorly is in part because we're not investing in those things that are public goods. Infrastructure is one of those, but it's infrastructure. Which affects, things of, for example, Louisiana, the way it hits fundamentally those that are the poorest. And those get hit harder. If you look at the reports today in the New York Times of what happened in New York, it's the people, it's the immigrants in illegal basements that ended up dying, with the floods. And so it's unconscionable that this is still the wealthiest, most powerful society in the world, that those things happen in the United States is unconscionable. There's no reason for that to happen in the United States. There is no fiscal constraint that, implies that we cannot do this. So the American government has, other than for political reasons, has all the ability to do what's needed to get the economy going back, again. So
You know, what's interesting to me is, you know, we know all this stuff, and I've been saying this stuff for years. And the longer we wait to do the infrastructure, as you pointed out, a decade ago it was $2 trillion, now it's 4.6. We wait another decade, it'll probably be $8 trillion, to a point to where you go, you know, you just throw up our hands, there's nothing we can do. And I think that's kind of where some people want us to be, in these positions where, well, sorry, we can't do anything. It's too late now, and I'm hearing the same voices on climate change. Well, we're already past the time of doing anything. Ah, the heck with it. Screw the grandkids.
You're absolutely right. It's a strategy. So the beautiful thing about this is that, you know, conservatives and libertarians and all those guys, they don't disguise these ideas. Friedman had it on the Wall Street Journal ages ago. He said, "Starve the beast." So cut the funds, you know, let the spending go on. So they are okay with spending, you know, provided the spending is not for solving the problems of the American working class. So we build schools in Afghanistan. Not sure for what purpose. You know, I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm all for building schools in Afghanistan and helping people in Afghanistan. The problem is that we left, and it's not clear we should have been in. But at any rate, we did build, and we spent $2 trillion over there. And, you know, we haven't spent it over here. So it is a peculiar notion. And those people that say that we don't have the money to do it here, and that's the part that I think it's important to notice. The people say, we don't have the money to do this here. But they are pushing for not only we should have done it over there, we should still be doing it over there. So we should stay there. So, you know, this is something that it's incongruent. You cannot say that we don't have the money to do it here, but we have the money to do it over there. And that part, I think it's important. We do have the money to do it over here. We don't have the political will to do it over here.
And that's exactly it. And I blame the working class of this country. I'll give you an example. When the Caldor fire was bearing down on Lake Tahoe, I tweeted out, you know, I finally heard about the story about 11 days after the fire started, only because it said, you know, fire bearing down on Lake Tahoe. The only reason that they reported this because it was going to where the rich people live. It had already burned a bunch of hundreds of homes and buildings, and it had burned the poor areas up already. But it was heading towards the tourist places, the casinos and the mansions. It was going to corporate America and the wealthy. And I had people beating me up going, you know, they're working class people live there. I go, of course I know that. But the only reason it got any attention is because now it was going to affect the wealthy. And that's when things matter. So the question I have is, you know, will we get to a point, do you think, where we start dealing with climate change when the mansions start flooding and you got rich people up on their roofs?
Oh, that's a difficult question to respond. But I, you know, in many ways, I think politically, because it's one of those things you can always kick the can and say, you know, there's nothing we can do. It will be globally very unevenly distributed, the impact of this. And I think, again, that, you know, and it's worse than you think, because I think that the American corporations, you know, for reasons that are strictly associated to their bottom line, they move jobs to places that force the working class, if they want to find jobs, to places that are, you know, utterly unsecure.
Yeah.
And so we still have that, you know, in places in which there are more, you know, in the old Rust Belt, people are moving out, and we're moving to places like Florida and, you know, and Arizona, and where there's no water, or, you know, and California. And so when you look at the trends, people are moving into places that are more dangerous. And, you know, and of course, the way this is sort of portrayed in the media is that people are irrational, and people are moving with their jobs. And those jobs are provided by American corporations that, I should say, to a great extent depend on, you know, I mean, we still have a military industrial complex that it's well-oiled and worked well in the United States. And a good chunk of that is associated to those things. So choices that we make that our corporations and the wealthy make, and that's where, you know, people end up being. So I'm somewhat pessimistic that, you know, we do have a chance if we do want, and the voices are overheard more clearly now. So I think that the Democratic Party is at a junction. So if we do pass, I mean, I want to be optimistic. So let's say that we pass the bipartisan infrastructure bill and we can get the sort of strayers in the Democratic Party in the Senate to vote for the what we apparently already they had agreed, which was the $3.5 trillion. I think that that could move us into a situation in which we get rolling in the right direction.
No, no, I'm with you. Here's what my fear is. My fear is Manchin saying we're going to pause this creates a situation where on, I think it's the 27th of September, because the unmovable caucus or whatever they're calling themselves, the 10 or 11 Dems who you know made a big kerfuffle. I fear that the $3.5 trillion doesn't get a vote, and then you get progressive Democrats saying, well, if we're not moving on the $3.5 trillion, we're not moving on the $1.2 trillion, and we end up with nothing.
I agree. I think that that's why last time we talked, I was more optimistic. Now I'm starting to be a little bit, scared that's a very plausible scenario at this point. So that we may end up with nothing. And that would be, I think, catastrophic for the country, for the world, and for the Democratic Party, too. So and I should say, for those that think that doesn't mean anything, that both parties are the same, it's worth remembering what's going on in Texas as we speak. So This has significant consequences in all kinds of levels of things. So it is important to, at extreme, even the survival of democracy itself. I think that these are important issues.
To answer my own question of a minute ago, the rich will never learn because we keep bailing them out. They build their houses on the ocean. They get wiped out. We rebuild them at taxpayer expense. So what makes me think they'll learn? Last question I've got for you. Got about a minute. Labor Day, the big holiday. What's the Vernengo family doing for the big holiday?
Oh, I'm working.
What, you work for Amazon?
Liberal arts schools. What would you know? So we don't stop for Labor Day. So I arrived in the United States on Labor Day. Labor Day, 1995. So I saw the parade in New York going down Fifth Avenue. So for me, it's an important memory. I'll be working. I'll be teaching, but I'll have some time for my students to discuss exactly that Labor Day and why American Labor Day is not the same Labor Day than the rest of the world, when the rest of the world commemorates a date of something that occurred in the Haymarket in Chicago.
May Day, May 1st.
So the way we bury the history of what happened to labor in this country.
Excellent point. Good stuff. Mateus, I appreciate you taking time for me. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Good stuff. Our good friend Mateus Vernengo, professor of economics there at Bucknell. And seriously, we bail the rich out every time they get themselves into a tangle. It's us. But when we get in trouble, to the curb with you. Quick break. Right back.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1949. That was the day known in New York as the Peekskill Riots. Internationally renowned African-American singer Paul Robeson was scheduled to give an open-air concert. He was known for his deep, moving voice, singing iconic songs like Shenandoah and the Ballad of Joe Hill. Robeson was active in the causes of civil and labor rights. In the Cold War hysteria after World War II, Robeson had been labeled a dangerous communist. The New York concert was originally planned to benefit the Civil Rights Congress. The group had been defending the Trenton Six, a group of six young black men sentenced to die in New Jersey for allegedly killing a white shopkeeper. The case was rife with legal abuses, but protests over the concert led to its cancellation. It was rescheduled, and the tickets were distributed to trade unionists in New York City. On the day of the concert, 2,500 union members made a human wall around the field to protect against protesters. Protesters gathered, hurling anti-black and anti-Jewish racial epithets. Pete Seeger opened the concert, followed by Robeson. The real trouble came when the concert ended and people tried to leave. The protesters threw rocks at passing cars, while policemen stood by and watched. 145 people were injured. Other concerts were canceled. Paul Robeson would continue to be harassed by the FBI. He was denied a passport due to his stance against anti-black discrimination in the United States and against colonialism in Africa.
I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night. alive as you and me.
Labor History in Tune, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and the Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryintune.com.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So back in 2013, we did a labor history tour. In fact, you can still get the book, Daddy, What's the Middle Class? Just go to ricksmithshow.com and we'll put out a way to get that to you. And we ended up going to Blair, West Virginia, where the Battle of Blair Mountain happened. In fact, we went to the mountain that at the time, back in 2013, the coal barons were actually trying to remove. They wanted to do mountaintop removal on that mountain because they'd already removed everything else. There were no buildings left. There were you would expect to see, you know, some remnants of old factories, of saloon, stores, anything, all gone. It looked like we were just dropped in the middle of a forest. And then to hear the stories that 10,000 miners were striking and you had thousands of company thugs and planes dropping bombs on the heads of workers and where the term redneck came from, you would have never known. That's why I was thrilled to see a story over at The Nation about the anniversary of the Battle of Blair Mountain, with this being the 100th anniversary. And that's why I've asked Samuel Fleischman to come talk with us. Samuel's a labor reporter and researcher. His piece, the Blair Mountain Coal Union Anniversary, a must read this holiday weekend. Samuel, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for having me, Rick. I'm a big fan of the show. So
I'm looking at this piece of yours, and I'm going, wow, you're a young guy. I doubt you learned about this in high school because nobody has. What made you pick this story?
Well, it really happened by coincidence for me. I was actually down in North Carolina researching textile unions and sort of the demise of that industry. And then I realized, just because I come from a labor family, labor organizing parents, I knew about the Battle of Blair Mountain. As you know, a lot of people don't know about it. And I decided, just on a whim, because I knew it was the 100th year anniversary, to go down there and just check it out, because I knew that there were still people living there, and that even though this happened 100 years ago, you know, those folks are still down there. There's still union folks that live there, that meet. And, you know, I just wanted to see what it was about. And like you said, look for what is still there, what remnants, what memorials. And it's, you know, the Mine Wars Museum in Matewan is a great, great museum. But if you're looking for a plaque for the actual Battle of Blair Mountain, you're going to have to drive 20 miles east out of Logan, and you're going to find, on an unmarked intersection, a little one iron plaque. So, yeah.
And that's where we ended up. We ended up going there and to a couple other places. And what was really strange about it is the person who was giving us the tour said, now, understand, we're being watched. And I'm going, how are we being watched? We're literally in the middle of nowhere. I haven't seen a house or a person for miles. All I see are trees. He goes, no, we're being watched. You just got to be aware of that. And when we stopped at the location where we were going to sit and do some interviews with folks, out of nowhere came, you know, probably 20, 30 cars of people who were wearing their Friends of Coal t-shirts and had their Friends of Coal bumper stickers, and all the men had sidearms and cowboy hats, and, you know, in a very threatening way going, you know, what you doing around here? And it was, you know, they were there to defend the coal industry, who literally were screwing half the people who were there to defend the coal industry, which is really just bizarre to me, Samuel.
Right. Well, that's really the history of West Virginia for the past 150 years, is that it's been brother against brother, neighbor against neighbor, Hatfield and McCoys, you know, feuding. And really, when you talk to the miners down there, what upsets them more, even more than, say, a coal baron like Don Blankenship, who is a notorious figure in the valley for just being robbing the people of their health insurance plans and, you know, closing down coal plants, is that, you know, they lost their friends and neighbors who, you know, decided to, you know, support, for the wrong reasons, these coal barons. So, yeah, it's been like that for a long time, and that's really the story too of Blair Mountain, in the sense that when you had these 10,000 miners marching into Logan, you know, it was defended. The sheriff of Logan County had created these defenses on the hills of Blair Mountain, and he had basically commissioned neighborhood people and people that he was employing and that were being employed in the mines to defend it. So really a part of the story too is just how this sort of class war divides, you know, people, neighbor against neighbors.
So. And it really is the Jay Gould quote, "I could pay half the working class to murder the other half," in action. I mean, because most of those guys were World War One vets who were coming back trying to make a living. And these coal companies screwed the government out of, you know, billions of dollars, cheating them. I mean, horrible, horrible people. And yet they were still able to get the government to, you know, to be, you know, kind of neutral at first and then, well, come in to crush it.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's I wouldn't even say crush it. It was more that, as you might have heard, is that, you know, just to give everyone a context of the stories, and we're sort of skipping forward here, but near the end of the battle, a lot of the miners were World War One veterans. So when the federal army came in, they didn't want to fight they didn't want to fight federal troops because they were veterans. So then they ended up laying down their arms. But it really was in the state of West Virginia. At every level, the state government was opposed to the United Mine Workers at the time. The Governor Morgan was staunchly anti-union, and he had the support of a consortium of business owners. So in local governments, at the county level, it was all pitted against the workers.
And what's interesting to me is, you know, you think that, well, you know, Samuel, that was 100 years ago. We're better than that now. We don't do those things now. We got a coal miner strike going on in Alabama right now. That's been going on since, what was it, April 1st they've been out since? You literally have people, scabs crossing the picket line, hitting them with cars, and nobody sticking up for those workers.
No, it's the same tried and true sort of method. Yeah, like you said, at Warrior Met Coal, it's been going on for 6 months. The story that happened in West Virginia, even after these coal mines were eventually organized after the passage of the National Labor Relations Act in the 1930s, it just kept happening again and again. So the same generations of folks whose grandparents, great-grandparents had fought at the Battle of Blair Mountain had to do the same thing again, right? There was the Massey strike in 84. Pittston strike was a huge strike in 1989. And it continues again because the system is set up in this sort of way where when profit comes over people, it's the eventuality, as you know, that they're going to start cutting corners. Conditions in the mines have always been some of the worst conditions, perhaps the worst conditions of any job in America. The death rate is so high compared to so many other jobs. So
yeah, no. A couple years ago, when they were trying to take the mine workers' health care away, we had gone to Charleston and we had gone to Fairmont and we had gone to a couple other places in West Virginia for the UMWA rallies to mobilize people. And I remember, you know, interviewing a lot of these miners who had spent, you know, 20, 30 years in the mine, young guys in their 50s who looked like they were in their 70s and 80s, unable to walk or basically breathe without oxygen. I mean, their lives were basically over. And you've got, you know, the coal barons going, no, we don't want to give them health care. Screw them. We've gotten what we needed out of them. Let's just do away with them. And I remember just thinking, how sadistic and how sick is this that these profiteers made so much money and now they're just going to cut these poor guys off to die. I couldn't help but be angry. But sadly, as a society, we didn't get angry with them.
No. And I want to take a moment, too, to point out that the coal miners in the UMWA, they really are some of the most staunch, intense union guys you'll ever find.
Absolutely.
It's no joke that John L. Lewis, the original president of UMWA, was the leader of the industrial unionism that ended up, you know, helping unionize some of the biggest industries in America. And, you know, I just want to say for a moment, too, the same thing goes for Rich Strumka, who sadly passed away a few weeks ago, who... you know, you have to imagine the 80s when coal is already declining and they're going through another series of strikes again and they're trying to take away their health care, as you say, that he's able to, you know, battle against that and battle against, you know, the things that are in a lot of ways out of your control when you're dealing with coal and you're dealing with a move to clean energy and that jobs are disappearing. So, you know, these guys were serious and they stay serious. When I went down there, the local 1440 in Matewan, meeting every month, very solid group of guys, still petitioning the state for their health benefits for Black Lung Disability Fund, which they're having trouble getting funding for. So these guys are still out there. You know, they're still living there. They never left, you know.
I mean, you think about the billions, the trillions of dollars that these coal barons have taken out of the ground in West Virginia over the decades, and how much that wealth being raped out of the ground could have been used to make that state. What are they, the sixth most poverty-ridden state in the country? With the wealth that's been extracted from their ground, they should not be that far down the list.
No, and I think, you know, like, and everyone should read the article too, because there's a message here about what happens when you don't invest in your communities and you take away from it without, you know, supporting them, is that there's a trend to what West Virginia has become as a state. You know, people forget, I mean, I wasn't even born, but say 30 years ago, that was a Democratic state. Bill Clinton carried that state by 13 points. So what happens when you don't invest in communities and people lose their jobs, people start to blame other sources for what's happening. They start to resent government programs, the government in general, and through a lot of other means. You know, now West Virginia is a heavily Republican state, and Senator Joe Manchin sort of an outlier in the context now. So,
yeah,
and one little point I will say too about those, all the coal, you know, the guys I was able to talk to, and I think when you talk to most coal miners, is that I think there's a misconception when you think about unions and you think about coal jobs, is that these guys just want a job to raise their families, you know, in a decent way. If that's digging coal, if that's building solar panels, they're fine with it. You know, it's really the coal operators and then legislators in the state of West Virginia who praise coal.
Yep.
Without really dealing with the ecological fallout of.
No, and that's the answer from my Democratic friends. I say this all the time. Look, working people just want to be able to support their families. They want to keep a roof over their family's head, food on the table in front of the kids, clothes on their back to go to school, maybe a vacation occasionally, maybe some nice things. Nobody's looking to make a killing, but they need to make a living. And it's got to be an honest, decent living. And sadly, the folks that I talk to who are trying to threaten us on the side of the road with, you know, with who knows what, that's what they wanted. And at that moment, you had Patriot Coal, you know, going bankrupt, filing bankruptcy, cutting off their pensions, cutting off all this stuff. And then, literally, they're the biggest guy there that I approached first. He literally lost his job a week before. And I had to ask him, I'm going, they screwed you. Why are you here defending them? And he looked at me and said, it's all we've got. And it's been framed in that way, Samuel, that it's all they've got, man. And if they lose coal, they're going to have nothing. And that's, to me, that's the other message.
Yeah. Well, you know, to highlight that, there was a proposal in the state legislature in West Virginia earlier this year to sort of look at how these communities could be rebuilt now that coal jobs are just leaving. And it's just a myth that it'll come back to the days it was. And that bill was shot down, the coal communities comeback plan. So these people are really in a tough spot, and in some ways, you know, it is. There are no jobs left when you talk to guys. You know, there's few places to go. So
yeah, and this is where the screwy thing is for me, because Joe Manchin could be the champion of a bipartisan massive infrastructure bill, much bigger than the $1.2 trillion plan. And he could also say, hey, look, we do need most of the things in the $3.5 trillion plan, and I want them here in my state so I can help my people get those solar panel jobs, the windmill jobs, whatever, and the services that we need, the infrastructure that we need. He could be like the you know, the savior of West Virginia by bringing home the bacon and the earmarks and the pork barrel, this and that. He could do that, but I'm confused at why just not happening.
Yeah, you know, I don't know whatever. I'm not the political guy to figure out what he's doing, but I will tell you that there's a real consequence to what's happened the last 3-4 decades.
Yeah.
And you see it, like I said, about how West Virginia is now, and now it's a Republican state, and the levels of poverty. So, yeah.
So last line of questioning I've got for you, because, you know, I look at the Battle of Blair Mountain and my experience going there, and seeing literally the entire town that we were told, imagine there was the saloon over there, the hotel over there. There was this, that, this whole massive infrastructure where they literally removed it brick by brick. There is nothing left except for what was the platform where the train tracks used to be and the train tracks they took up. Did you find that same kind of scenario, that the history of this has been removed in many of the places, and really only those guys showing up to the 1440 meetings are the ones trying to keep it alive? Because the museum, I don't believe, was there back in 2013. They were trying, they were working, but there was nothing there yet. Did you see that same thing that I saw?
I would agree with you. And I think that's the same way that they changed, you know, the way they do coal mining now is not to remove coal seams from the mountain. They literally remove the mountain from the coal. So the same way that they're destroying the environment, they really tried to wipe the history of what happened in all these haulers and all these small towns of West Virginia. There were no museums besides the cities themselves falling apart and these towns falling apart. There's no plaques, there's no memorandum, no memorials. And it really was, at the end of the day, it came down to these miners were the ones who funded this museum, which has become of some local renown. And when you go inside the museum, the artifacts are their parents' artifacts, so their grandparents. You see a canary cage, and it's someone's great uncle's canary cage, and the pickaxes and the guns they found from the battle. It was
their family legacy, their heritage.
And just a deep respect that those guys had, a code that they had, and they're the ones living it out. So, yes.
And it's important to remember, I hope folks will take a look at the article, "The Biggest Uprising Since the Civil War Happened Here 100 Years Ago," written by Samuel Fleischman. We'll get links out to the Nation article so you can take a look at it. Samuel, I appreciate the time. Great talking with you. Hope you'll come back again real soon.
Thanks. Appreciate it, Rick.
Good stuff. But here's the thing, and just real quick to highlight, everywhere we went on our labor history tour, the exact same thing. It's just not the coal miners. It's just not the coal companies in West Virginia. It's all over the place. They've eviscerated labor's history. That was the one thing that we found. And the places where there still were things, like nice plaques and stuff, it's been whitewashed and corporatized because they needed the funding for it. That's where we've got to reclaim our history, remember our history, especially this weekend. But make sure you check out the piece, "The Biggest Uprising Since the Civil War." Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1928. 300 musicians working in Chicago went on strike against 250 movie theaters. They were protesting their impending replacement by talking pictures. This was part of a nationwide wave of protests by the American Federation of Musicians. The union had amassed $1.5 million to fight laying off musicians who played at the movies. From the inception of cinema, Thomas Edison had hoped to merge sound and film. Since this did not happen in the early days of movies, the films used intertitles and had musical accompaniment. This music ranged from an orchestra in the large urban theaters to a single piano player in smaller theaters. Across the country, 75,000 musicians worked in movie theaters. This live music played an essential role in setting the mood of the film, building dramatic tension, and enhancing the movie-going experience. However, there was considerable difficulty matching other sound to film visuals. Western Electric and Bell Telephone produced the first commercially viable movie sound system. It hooked up a very large phonograph to a film projector. This was first used in the film Don Juan in 1926. But the next year, in October of 1927, the opening of the Al Jolson film The Jazz Singer marked the introduction of the first successful talking picture. Talking pictures were a boom to many comedic vaudevillian performers such as Jack Benny and the Marx Brothers, who could now translate their comedy onto film. As a result, musicians, members of the American Federation of Musicians, were no longer needed to provide musical accompaniment. By the end of 1928, nearly 2,000 theater musicians in the U.S. were unemployed. By 1929, nearly half of the nation's movie theaters had converted to sound. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.